Listen up now.
For your information, this podcast contains no antibiotics, no synthetic hormones, no toxic pesticides, and no GMOs. It is, however, made with peanuts and may contain various impurities, including, but not limited to, blasphemy, impiety, profanity, heresy, scurrility, and derogation.
Not good.
It's okay.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been about 4 months since my last episode.
Where were you? Why did you call? Where have you been? We were worried to death.
Oh, calm down, Father. These are my sins. I said we were going to skip over a whole lot of stuff and find out why Gretel is always crying. But we're not.
Why the fuck not?
Because I ran into a buzzsaw of serious research issues, and it left me with way more questions than answers. Anyway, I didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition. That's what sort of happened.
What the fuck?
Hey there, and welcome back to the Hansel and Gretel Code. This here is episode 36.
Oh, yes, y'all! We are gonna do this again! Like it's normal anymore!
In our last episode, we found out that Hansel's little white cat, well, it's a symbol representing the whole kit and caboodle of Norse and Germanic mythology, which means it also represents intuition and the intuitive practice known as Scyther.
What's that?
Well, that's the Germanic equivalent of theurgy and Hermeticism. And by the way, all of that Northern European mythology, it's actually a Bible.
What?
Yeah. Hey, it's no different from the Old Testament.
You can't be serious.
Oh yeah, why not? All the stories in it are about the deities of a religion that predates Christianity, just like the Old Testament. And instead of stories coming out of the deserts of the Middle East, these stories come from the forests and fjords north of the Alps.
True that.
And just because there's more than one single god in the Norse Germanic religion, that doesn't mean their Bible stories are any less truthful than the Hebraeo-Christian versions. Yeah, sure, their facts may differ a whole hell of a lot from the ones we're most familiar with, but facts do not constitute truth. And since everybody's religious facts and stories are pretty fucking different, God only knows whose version actually corresponds to reality.
What is reality?
See, when it comes to religion, anybody's religion, facts are not the point. So let's not get hung up on them.
And why not?
Because truth, with a capital T, is never in the facts.
Well, where is it?
Well, truth is in, let's just call it someplace else.
I see.
Well, you gotta realize, in the Germanic Norse Bible, which is to say the facts and stories about their deities, it was only written down in the 13th century, long after everyone, including all the storytellers, got themselves baptized.
Yeah, so what?
Well, it was only after filtering down through about 1,000 years of Christianity that the stories got written down. So whatever they were originally, they were all retold through the dense filter of a well-established Christian perspective.
Ah.
And for what it's worth, they were also retold by Neil Gaiman, too.
Ooh!
Anyway, reading through some of that stuff, that's how we learn that white cats are associated with Freyja, the Norse goddess who gave her name to that day of the week we all look forward to. You know, TGIF.
Hooray!
Now, we also learned that her Germanic Anglo-Saxon name was Östra.
Who cares?
Well, that revelation clued us into the fact that Frau Holzacker's impatient correcting of Hansel, that was a veiled but clever reference to syncretism, the method used by Vatican missionaries to win over the native Germans. You know, we'll let you keep that weird old name, Östra, but you better believe that it now means, Easter Sunday.
All right, already, get on with it!
Well, I really thought we were going to speed things up this time and get to the source of Gretel's constant crying, which, I gotta tell you, is one hell of a wild historic surprise. But that's going to have to wait, because I kind of got mesmerized by the campfire in the next line of the fairy tale.
I'm often asked, what are campfire girls all about? Well, in campfire girls, there are girls and boys sometimes.
Oh, that's so good.
What do campfire girls do?
We see that they have lit the camp on fire.
Yes, sure. That's the party starting. I want to hear that. Party, party, party.
Part 1.
Teil 1, in which we learn why Ed Sullivan didn't want Jim Morrison singing his full-throat version of Light My Fire on live TV.
Now the door. Here they are with their newest hit record.
And now, Der Jürgen. Here he is with the newest line of our fairy tale.
So gingen sie lang und kamen endlich mitten in den großen Wald. Da machte der Vater ein großes Feuer an.
They went along thusly and finally came into the heart of the great forest. There, the father built a great big fire. Now this all sounds pretty logical, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. As far as plot and storytelling go, the logic seems obvious. But we're talking symbolism here. And this line? It's another important reference to syncretism.
No way.
Oh yeah. In fact, there's more syncretism in that campfire than we can shake a marshmallow on a stick at.
Nonsense.
Hey, there's also a whole hell of a lot of sexuality involved here too.
Seriously?
Yep.
Ooh, I like that.
Well, before we cut to the chase, just remember that the woods in Hansel and Gretel, they're a symbol of the unconscious.
I remember.
Right. So, lighting a campfire in the woods, that could mean bringing a touch of light into the unconscious. You know, bringing some consciousness or greater awareness into our lives. Because, you remember, this is a fairy tale about us and our lives, right?
No.
Yeah, well, making this fire, it could be about making an effort to learn something that we weren't otherwise conscious or aware of before.
Pseudo-intellectual bullshit.
Yeah, you sort of have a point. Because as far as metaphors go, linking this campfire to raising consciousness sounds awfully abstract. And in this instance, it's so nonspecific, it doesn't lead us anywhere. Not even down into some interesting, time-wasting rabbit hole.
Why not?
Hey, bear with me here. Lighting a fire could mean nothing more than what it logically implies. A way to fool the kids into staying put. You know, give them a nice warm fire to huddle up next to. That way, they're less likely to notice when you go sneaking off back home without them.
Precisely.
Funny, though. Even the most ordinary campfire has a kind of ritual feel to it, don't you think?
No.
Come on. We know from all the way back in episode 3 that the early Germans considered the forest to be a sacred space. According to the Roman historian Tacitus, the forest might as well have been their pre-Christian cathedral. It's where their deities lived, and it's where they went to worship. More importantly, that feeling for the sacred nature of the forest, that has never left the Germanic psyche.
How do you know that?
Hey, all you gotta do is take one look at the famous Cologne Cathedral to see that it's built to resemble a forest.
I don't think so.
Seriously, use your imagination and you'll see what I mean.
I see flowers.
I see 6 flowers.
And what I'm getting at here is that lighting a campfire in the forest, it's like lighting a candle in church. Except the fairy tale says, this is a great big fire. So we're probably looking at some great big religious ritual. Something a hell of a lot more serious and elaborate than lighting just one little candle.
Yes, I can see that.
And then consider that the mother wanted to sacrifice the kids, pretty much as scapegoats. Which is what we said in episode 15 and in episode 19. So we could be talking some allusion to the ultimate Catholic ritual, the sacrifice of the Mass.
Huh?
I don't need to tell you the Catholic Mass is one hell of a busy ritual. And it's all about the sacrifice of the ultimate Christian scapegoat. You know, the guy who died for our sins.
That's not funny.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean it to be.
Oh!
Now, we may have started out spitballing here with this ritual business, but I think we're onto something.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Because what do you know? Lighting ritual fires is a significant practice going all the way back to the dawn of German and European history.
And we know that how?
Well, that's because it pops up in Fraser's Golden Bough. And in a really big way. Big enough, in fact, to match the great big fire of the fairy tale.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about Sir James Fraser's famous text, The Golden Bough. A Study in Magic and Religion. It's a really interesting read. And in its unabridged third edition, it runs to 12 volumes and somewhere around 4,000 pages. I'll leave a link.
Please, don't do that.
Hey, it's okay. I'll leave a link to the abridged version.
Good idea.
Anyway, I think we've hit the jackpot of meaning here. Because there's one long-ass chapter in Fraser titled The Fire Festivals of Europe. And in it, he gives us over 200 pages worth of historical facts and footnotes regarding the various types of ritual fires.
I don't get it.
Well, let me just read you one very short snippet.
All right, if you insist.
All over Europe, the peasants have been accustomed, from time immemorial, to kindle bonfires on certain days of the year, and to dance round or leap over them.
Sounds interesting.
Well, if you're thinking there must be some connection between these ritual fires and the nursery rhyme about Jack jumping over a candlestick, I'd have to agree with you. What's more interesting, though, is that the various types of ritual bonfires, they all have one thing in common.
What's that?
Well, setting them was an integral part of pre-Christian religion.
Really? Oh.
And so, once again, we're talking syncretism here.
How?
Oh, that's easy. See, these ritual bonfires, they were so important and popular that people refused to give them up, even after getting themselves baptized. So, like it or not, the Vatican missionaries were forced to let everyone keep their tradition alive, even though it all started out as a strictly pagan enterprise. Now, all they could do was give these fires a new Christian name and meaning, and hope that the new Christian meaning would eventually stick. Of course, that was like changing the name of French fries to Freedom Fries, and about as successful as getting Americans to give up fries for Brussels sprouts. Which is why they had to constantly correct everyone and remind them of that new Christian meaning. Exactly the way Frau Holzhacker impatiently corrected Hansel about his little white kitty cat.
Holy shit!
Now, in one respect at least, they were pretty fucking successful.
Really?
Yeah, consider the fact that most of us have already forgotten the pre-Christian origin of those fires. Not to mention the connection between Hansel's little white kitty cat and the goddess Freya. Except, guess what?
What?
It was only around 200 years ago, when this fairy tale was first published, that people were just starting to forget about those connections. See, for century upon century, the church had tried its damnedest to not only make people forget those pagan origins, but to make people give up those ritual fires altogether.
How do you know that?
Because Fraser tells us that in the 8th century, the Vatican authorized a number of synods, big deal meetings of bishops and bigwigs, and one consistent item on their agenda was, let's put an end to these heathenish rites. In fact, that's how we of today know for certain that these fires were part of pre-Christian religion.
I don't get it.
Well, tacked onto the pronouncements of those 8th century synods was a funny little church document called Indiculus Superstitionum et Paganiarum. Small index of superstitions and paganism.
Ridiculous.
No, that's indiculous, not ridiculous. All we have left of that document is the table of contents, but it lists 30 different pre-Christian beliefs and rituals those bishops and bigwigs wanted to get rid of. And halfway down that list were those ritual fires, many of which are still practiced just about everywhere in Europe.
Interesting.
Well, apparently, the ritual fire that particularly annoyed those church fathers was known as the Notfeuer.
Yeah, it's okay.
Thank you. And unlike the other bonfires, the Easter fire or the Midsummer or St. John's fire, for instance, it wasn't kindled on some set day of the year. It was more of an emergency thing. In fact, the word Notfeuer tends to be translated as the need or even emergency fire. And it might have been so named because, as Jakob Grimm says in his Teutonic mythology, it was used in time of need.
Oh, I thank you very much, Captain Obvious.
Now, for the record, that time of need usually involved an outbreak of disease, especially that of livestock. Now, in modern German, the word Not, that connotes hardship or dire straits, and it applies to any sort of emergency. So in the case of our fairy tale famine, Not is exactly what the Holzhacker family is going through.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm not saying that the fire Herr Holzhacker made in this line is a Notfeuer, although the metaphoric connection is reasonably obvious. Here's the thing. The one form of ritual fire the church was successful in eradicating was indeed the Notfeuer. Except, guess what?
What?
The note fire. It's still with us.
No way.
Well, you see, it got moved. Instead of being kindled outdoors, in the fields or forests, as it had always been, it got moved indoors. Into, you guessed it, into church.
Is this true?
Yep. In its fully Christianized, syncretic form, the note fire became the Catholic novena.
Now a lot sounds like grade A bullshit.
Well, a novena is a ritual request for help in emergencies. It includes a 9-day vigil in church.
You are going to be here for a while, so you better get comfortable.
And while there's no bonfire involved, the ritual is accompanied by the lighting of a ginormous number of votive candles. And while all memory of paganism seems to have been completely wiped out of modern novenas, the connection, it's never been forgotten by the Vatican theologians.
Are you sure about that?
Well, two short quotations of protest from the Catholic Encyclopedia, they make it pretty clear that well into the 20th century, the connection was both a sore point and an embarrassment. Take a listen.
Catholics know from their own experience that the novena is no pagan superstitious custom, but one of the best means to attain signal heavenly graces. Even if it was connected with an earlier practice of the pagans, it nevertheless had in itself no vestige of superstition.
So what's your point?
Connecting the dots between a note fire and a novena, it gives us the ritual this line of the fairy tale is hinting at, and the syncretism behind that not-so-secret connection.
Clever.
For all of the earliest Germanic Christians, there must have remained an unspoken intent that, just in case the new Vatican God didn't come through and answer their prayers, there's no harm in hoping the old deities might come to their rescue through the very same ritual.
Yes, you're getting two for the price of one.
Now that would seem to explain why the Vatican was so anxious to get people to stop lighting those big bonfires.
Exactly.
Except there's another, juicier reason why those peasants refused to give up their fires.
What's that?
Turns out, there was a huge sexual component to all of the fire rituals.
What a surprise!
And not just because so many of them included fertility acts, rites. And that's where Jakob Grimm comes in. His Teutonic mythology gives us 29 pages of facts and footnotes about those same ritual fires that Fraser wrote about. The Easter fires and Midsummer fires and those famous emergency note fires. Now, philologist that he is, he also gives us his take on why they're called note fires. So, as I said, in modern German, note indicates a situation of emergency. But Jakob tells us that in Old High German, the root of the word Not, it also includes the idea of friction. He also tells us that a Notfeuer had to be started from scratch by rubbing two pieces of wood together.
So, why?
Well, naturally, it's all about the friction. The procedure involved rubbing a stick in either a grooved piece of wood or one with a hole in it. It was ridiculously obvious to everyone that the stick symbolized a you-know-what, and the groove symbolized an anatomical feature of the female persuasion. The resultant fire was then considered the baby.
Dirty, dirty, dirty. It's easily as dirty as can be.
But there's even more sexuality in the ritual than that.
Are you kidding me?
No. in a 14th century text known as the Chronicles of Lanercost, a collection of historical fun facts covering about 150 years of local British history. The entry for the year 1268, dude, that was a humdinger.
Let the reader remember that when the herds of cattle in Laodonia were ravaged this year by the pest called lung sickness, certain cattle breeders, who were monastery folk, taught the ignorant rustics to make fire by rubbing pieces of wood together and to set up an image of Priapus, and in this way to help their animals. After a Cistercian lay brother had done this, he dipped the testicles of a dog in holy water and sprinkled the animals with it.
Ugh! Ew!
See, it's that sexual aspect of the Notfire ritual, my dear listeners, that must have given ordinary people faith in its power. And at the same time, gave the good holy fathers of the Vatican the heebie-jeebies. After all, not only had they themselves taken vows of chastity, but they expected all good Christians to follow their pious example and keep their sexuality on a leash.
Amen.
Part 2.
Teil 2, in which Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer, shows up on New Year's Eve and separates the partygoers from the party poopers.
Happy New Year!
Yes, it's time to party now. Yo ladies, feel like dancing?
Please just get out of my face.
Converting most everyone north of the Alps to Christianity was a long slog. And syncretism wasn't the strategy Vatican missionaries started out with. So, like modern-day Taliban, they destroyed pagan images and shrines. They cut down sacred trees. They would happily turn whole forests into a field of tree trunks. All
for Jesus.
Glory! Glory! Amen and amen.
Well, that, of course, was a hell of a lot of work. So they rightly figured that a top-down strategy would be way more efficient. Getting the local rulers to convert, that was key to getting all their subjects to convert as a matter of law. The most famous of those laws being that of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charlemagne. Except the penalty for breaking that law was death.
Uh-oh.
And while that worked fairly well, it seems obvious that syncretism, as advocated by Pope Gregory I, was a more reasonable approach.
Maybe.
Case in point, syncretism didn't sit well with every one of those missionaries. In fact, it annoyed the fuck out of many Vatican missionaries and bigwigs.
Oh my God.
For instance, back in the 3rd century, a certain Caesarius of Arles made a name for himself and achieved sainthood by constantly busting people's balls preaching against syncretism and the survival of pagan rituals. Interestingly, it wasn't those ritual fires he kept harping on so much. It was the practice of partying on New Year's.
Motherfucker.
Yeah. As one of Christianity's most famous party poopers, he was particularly annoyed by people dressing up and wearing a very specific kind of mask to the party.
What's that?
Well, it was a stag mask, complete with antlers. You know, just like a reindeer. Now, I guess he was pretty successful, since you don't see anybody running around with antlers anymore, do you?
I'm not so sure.
Well, not after Christmas. And you don't see anybody wearing them to a typical New Year's Eve party.
I don't know anymore.
Well, my point is that a New Year's Eve party is, in fact, one of those traditional pagan rites the church wanted to get rid of. Now, to put all this into context, we have to realize that for some guys, syncretism was just too permissive. Guys like Caesarius were so holy, they had zero tolerance for anything connected to pre-Christian religion or practice. Even simple names. Well, it was up to them. Easter Sunday would still be called Pascha after Passover. And come to think of it, still is in most countries. Anyway, to imagine paganism was living on in Christian rituals must have made their blood boil. So as you read more about these guys, you get the sense that deep down, what they really hated wasn't paganism. It was fun. You know, just plain old fun.
I never drink. Why?
This Saint Caesarius in particular. I mean, in addition to being a famous party pooper, the story goes that as a young monk, he was put in charge of provisions for his monastery. But it wasn't long before his fellow monks voted him out of that job.
Why?
Well, since he had the keys to the larder, he forced them to eat and drink according to his personal views on austerity.
There will be no fruity desserts.
Excellent.
And then there was our old friend Boniface. Now, we already know how he made a name for himself, by chopping down the most famous tree in all of Germany and baptizing Germans by the thousands.
He was holy.
Oh yeah, he was holy all right. Just like old Caesarius was. He really hated when his fellow clergymen didn't live up to his personal holy standards.
There was nothing wrong with that.
True enough. Just hear me out, though. Around the year 742, Boniface wrote a long, whiny letter to Pope Zachary I, complaining about priests and bishops in Germany who were ebrios et incuriosi vel venatores.
What the fuck does that mean?
That means they went around drinking and hunting and otherwise enjoying life. And that included partying. With girls.
I like it.
Now, it turns out the guy who pissed Boniface off the most was the Bishop of Trier, a certain Milo. Milo must have been a very fun-loving, very unholy guy. Anyway, while enjoying the perks of his bishopric, Milo hadn't done anything to earn that office. He wasn't appointed by the Vatican. Oh no, Milo inherited his office from his dad, his good sainted father, Saint Ludvinus, who had been the bishop. He died and left it to him.
A great gentleman, very, very tough.
Argy derg derg.
And sainted Ludvinus was, because aside from Milo, sainthood kind of ran in the family.
Is that so?
Yep. See, Milo's father, Saint Ludvinus, was the son of Saint Waterinus, who was the son of Saint Sigrada, the nephew of Saint Leodegarius, and the brother-in-law of Saint Basinus. So I can only imagine what a Thanksgiving dinner at that house could have been like. Well, in addition to being a prude, which was his right, and a tattletale, which is kind of slimy, Boniface was also an envious ecclesiastic bureaucrat who longed to be top dog in all of Germany.
What happened?
Well, he had a guy named Gevalobius kicked out of office as Bishop of Mainz, and he had himself put in his place, which might have pleased him, except for the fact that as Bishop of Mainz, he had to play second fiddle to the Bishop of Cologne, and that prize remained forever out of his reach.
Ouch!
Now, what I'm getting at here is that the whole concept of syncretism, it invites a think. So, I mean, if the church officially tolerated, even encouraged it, why was it always trying to put an end to it?
I don't know.
Well, if you ask me, I'm thinking just one thing. Politics. There had to be plenty of conservative hardliners in the church who out and out hated the idea of syncretism, and whose idea of fun, it can only be God knows what.
You are under my control, and I will be your authority forever and ever and ever.
Opposing them, there had to be just as many, if not more, liberals who supported syncretism. Not necessarily because they cared about converting pagans to Christianity, which was pretty much their bread and butter, but because they not so secretly or discreetly enjoyed the festivities.
Yeehaw!
I mean, what's the harm, right? Sure, there was a whole lot of hanky-panky involved. All in all, pagan rituals don't seem to have required anything more elaborate than a nice campfire, a tasty animal sacrifice, plenty of beer, and only an occasional human sacrifice.
That's right, baby.
Now, strictly speaking, eliminating human sacrifice, beyond that first scapegoating of the Christian Savior, that was one of the main positive effects of Christianity. Something that kind of gets lost in the Vatican pearl-clutching over sexuality.
Sex is normal. You should have it also with yourself.
Ugh! Well then.
But let's leave the sexuality business and get on with our story.
Boo!
Part 3.
Teil 3. In which we stumble upon a campfire of biblical proportion. Believe me, we're talking big here. This thing is huge.
Biblical. Epic. Fucking biblical.
But before we go any further, let's take another listen to the manuscript version of this line, and then compare it with the Grimm's revision. Now, by the way, the Grimms altered this line right from the get-go, in their first 1812 edition. And they were so satisfied with the effect, they left it as is through all of their subsequent editions. So, take it away, Jürgen.
So gingen sie lang und kamen endlich mitten in den großen Wald. Da machte der Vater ein großes Feuer an.
They went along thusly, and finally came into the heart of the great forest. There, the father built a great big fire. Well, now here's the Grimm's revision.
Als sie mitten in den Wald gekommen waren, sprach der Vater, Nun sammelt Holz, ihr Kinder. Ich will ein Feuer anmachen, damit ihr nicht friert. Hänsel und Gretel trugen Reisig zusammen, einen kleinen Berg hoch.
When they had reached the middle of the forest, the father said, Now, children, pile up some wood, and I will light a fire, that you may not be cold. Hansel and Gretel gathered brushwood together as high as a little hill.
So the revision doesn't tell us much more about syncretism. What it does, though, is tell us something more about the Grimms themselves.
Yeah? Like what?
Well, do you remember back in episode 12, I said that the Grimms were actively tossing out softball clues to help ordinary readers suss out the symbolic meaning of the fairy tale?
No.
Well, this line offers more evidence to support such a wild-ass, implausible claim, which, I gotta tell you, isn't at all far-fetched. It only seems implausible, because mainstream Grimm scholarship hasn't found what we have, or caught on to the possibility.
Why not?
Well, it's because nobody's done the work that you and I are doing here. Not for at least 100 years. See, all we're doing is paying attention to what's written in between the lines. And sure, it's a lot of work, and it takes a hell of a long time. But it is a serious pleasure. Which is exactly what James Joyce meant when he famously, and only slightly facetiously, told Max Eastman, "The demand that I make of my reader is that he should devote his whole life to reading my works." Now, Joyce specifically said he wanted to give the reader pleasure, even with a difficult-to-fathom work like Finnegan's Wake. And the way to find that pleasure is to do exactly what you and I are doing here. Carefully reading between the lines. Now, figuring out why people stopped doing this with fairy tales like Hansel and Gretel, that's an interesting mystery in itself.
No, it's not.
Sure, there's the difficulty involved, but there's got to be more to it than that. Now, I suspect it's connected to the fact that two of the most influential folklorists of the 20th century, Marianne Rumpf and Lutz Röhrig.
Your German pronunciation must be much better.
Yeah, I get it. Apparently, they pronounced Hansel and Gretel and other tales like it to be nothing more than Schreckmärchen.
Try again. Come on.
Scare and warning tales meant only for children. Now, by virtue of their professorial authority, this facile meaning became enshrined as professional folklore dogma.
Naturally.
Hell, even Jungians and Freudians avoid going into all the details. And in whatever work they do, they always invoke the catchphrases and code words of their own dogma.
Indubitably.
Well, you and I are examining the metaphors in each and every line of the fairy tale, and letting the material take us where it, and not anybody's dogma, leads. And that's what it takes to get the clearest picture of what's written between the lines, which is where the true and most satisfying meaning of any fairy tale can be found. It's also where we are going to find the name of the true author of Hansel and Gretel, the person responsible for slipping all of that meaning between the lines in the first place.
Enough rants.
Okay, rant over. Now let's get back to working on this line of the fairy tale. The main detail the Grimms changed was to add the wood needed for a campfire and have the father tell the children to gather it.
So what?
Well, bear with me here, because when I first worked my way through the fairy tale, I didn't attach any great importance to this either. Telling the kids to go fetch wood, it's such a logical little detail. Except in his Teutonic mythology, Jakob Grimm tells us that having children go house to house collecting wood for those ritual fires, that was a necessary part of the ritual. So that made for a nice little connection. But I was actually more impressed by that business of stacking the firewood as high as a little hill.
Why?
Because it reminded me of our hero from episode 17, Jan Hus, the Christian martyr who was burnt alive, the dastardly villain who was duly executed for his heretical views on Christianity, poverty, and papal politics. See, the historical record states that the wood for his execution was piled up into a little hill as high as his chin.
Oh my God.
Yeah, well, I kind of left it at that. I figured there was nothing more to this line than a gratuitous reminder about the injustice and cruelty of the Vatican's treatment of Jan Hus.
That's not funny.
Yeah, but then a funny thing happened.
What?
Much later in the story, I was researching another innocuous but puzzling detail. Specifically, the line that has the witch saying she's ready to boil Hansel up in a pot. But first, she wants to prepare some dough for baking. Presumably to make bread or croutons to go with her Hansel soup.
Oh boy.
See, I was confused by the word used for dough in the manuscript version. Because the way it was spelled, it could have meant a pond. You know, like with frogs and dragonflies and lily pads. So I opened up the Grimm's dictionary to check. Well, as simple as the word dough actually is, in case of doubt, it's always worth consulting the Grimm's dictionary, on the off chance that it might be some sneaky little clue to a literary reference that only the Grimm's 19th century German readers would have known about. And sure enough, among the many literary references the Grimm's did supply, there was one little quote from Luther. And when you find any sort of reference to Luther in between the lines of a Grimm's tale, it's usually worth the time and trouble it takes to dig deeper and follow up on it. Now, I'm not going to bore you with all the details.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's just say Luther led me on a merry chase through the Bible. From Romans 5, which has little, if anything, to do with Hansel and Gretel, to Exodus 1, which has a hell of a lot to do with our story and the Grimms themselves. In fact, more specifically, it has to do with the Grimm's satiric use of Hansel and Gretel, as I hinted back in episode 20, but haven't yet shared.
Why won't you share?
Well, I will eventually. It's just going to have to be in another or maybe a bonus episode. Anyway, Luther finally dropped me off at Jeremiah 7. And that, my dear friends and listeners, is exactly where the revision of this line of the fairy tale was meant to take us.
Why don't you go ahead and show me?
Ooh, I will. Right after this commercial break.
Does your typical night suffer from horribly boring night syndrome? We got a solution for you. This Tuesday, October 17th.
Oop, sorry, wrong commercial. Quick shout out, though, to fellow podcasters Hunter and Al of EntitledOpinion.com. Thank you, and thank you for tossing some dough my way. Their podcast is called Entitled Opinion. And I just recorded an episode with them that should come out in the very near future. When it does come out, I'll leave a link. And a big thank you to my friend and fellow podcaster, Danny Van Leeuwen of Health Hats, the podcast, for his generous and continued support. Thanks, Danny. Of course, y'all know I signed up for that Buy Me a Coffee outfit because I could use the grace of your support.
Forget it.
Well, if nothing else, your contributions let me know you're out there listening. But if you'd prefer to hang on to your dough, a rating or review in your podcast app, that would work nicely too.
I said no.
And now, back to the story.
Well, alrighty then. As I was saying, the Grimms led us to Luther, who led us on a dance through the Bible, and finally dropped us off in the Old Testament, at Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 18, which says, "The children gather wood, the fathers light the fire, and the women knead the dough." Okay, all well and good, you say. Jeremiah 7, interesting, but so what?
You just took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, finding hidden biblical quotes in a fairy tale, that may seem awfully far-fetched, or even annoying, like we're making it up at worst, or at best, like it's some BS game for literary snobs.
Oh my.
Except it's neither of those things. See, Jeremiah 7 could only be identified by the close resemblance of the Grimm's revision to the specifics of verse 18. Except, verse 18 isn't the point. Verse 18 is the pointer. See, like a flag in Google Maps, it's showing us we're in the right neighborhood. And it's the neighborhood we were meant to explore. And boy, oh boy, what we were meant to find there, it's so important and so sophisticated. I'm pretty sure the Grimms didn't add this revision themselves.
Oh my god! Ridiculous!
See, I suspect that Henriette Dorothea Wild, the young lady who first told the story to Wilhelm, and who later became Frau Grimm, I think she forgot to add the detail of the wood gathering. And my suspicion, it's based on the fact that a very particular and very important person in the know, whose name I will reveal in a much later episode, well, that person clued the Grimms into what was missing.
Oh no, you can't be serious. That is some bullshit right there.
Believing me isn't the point. Jeremiah 7 is, because it turns out to be a brilliant elaboration of something this fairy tale is trying to tell us. In other words, it's another instance of metalepsis. You remember I explained what a metalepsis is back in episode 19, right?
No, sir.
Okay, fair enough. Episode 17 was pretty far back there. See, metalepsis is a bridge or a signpost in one work pointing to an earlier instance of the same or similar symbol appearing in another work or context. Back in episode 17, I said that Hansel and Gretel is filled with them. And this Grimm's revision, that qualifies as another metalepsis because it points to a biblical verse. The really important thing about metalepsis is that the earlier symbol carries some of the weight of meaning meant to be expressed in the later work. In the context of Hansel and Gretel, Jeremiah 7 shows up first and foremost as a coded message condemning syncretism.
No, really? How is that possible?
Well, not from the perspective of those conservative Vatican hardliners who hated it. No, no. It's from the perspective of the pre-Christian deities who are pissed off at the Germans for listening to the Vatican missionaries.
Oh God, oh Jesus.
But that is not all.
Reinforcing the anti-Vatican tenor of the entire fairy tale, there's also a second coded message condemning the Vatican and its inquisitors.
Let me tell you why that is bullshit.
Well, you don't have to believe me. Just for the record, let's look at verses 3 through 8.
This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words. If you do not follow other gods, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors, forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless.
Are you talking to me?
Well, this is an admonition from Big Jaws himself, Yahweh, directed at his chosen people, of course. Except in the context of Hansel and Gretel, this becomes a passage of Norse mythology, which we've already said might as well be a pagan Bible.
Are you out of your mind much?
Well, see, you gotta mentally put those words in the mouth of Odin or Wotan or even Freya. And so what you get then is a whole different ironic meaning. Instead of being an admonition directed at the Jews, as in the Old Testament, our author used it as a metaleptic literary trick, to be read as if it were the native pre-Christian deities gifting the primeval forests to the early Germanic Norse people, and then warning them not to trust the Vatican missionaries and their deity.
Oh my God.
Now the last part of verse 8, it even becomes an ironic statement calling the papist syncretic messages worthless.
Oh my God.
Now in the very same vein, verse 18 continued.
They pour out drink offerings to other gods to arouse my anger.
So, for other gods, Just imagine Freya getting pissed off about Germans making sacrifices to the new Christian God.
Jesus Christ.
And speaking of sacrifices, we have another reason to understand why we were all meant to recall Jeremiah 7 in this line of the fairy tale. See, here are verses 30 and 31.
The people of Judah have done evil in my eyes, declares the Lord. They have built the high places to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, something I did not command, nor did it enter my mind.
Did somebody do it?
Well, it's never a good idea to contradict someone more powerful than a mafia don. But in Genesis 22, the story of Abraham and Isaac, didn't this same guy order a hit on Abe's son, Isaac?
No, sir.
Well, this wasn't from the wiretap, but I quote,
"Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you."
I'm not saying nothing.
Now, at the time Hansel and Gretel was written, this biblical godfather, or I mean God the Father, was considered to be the same guy in both the Old Testament and the New. And his message was essentially consistent, at least as far as his commandments go. Although, according to Jung, spreading his New Testament message was an important advance in Western civilization.
What is that?
Well, one particular advancement was that Christianity put an end to human sacrifice.
That's nice.
So the early Germans, they weren't so big into human sacrifice. But the Druids? They sure were. In fact, the Druid use of the so-called wicker man, a big straw wicker guy with a human tied up inside, that makes them the historic ancestors of Burning Man. And that brings us back, full circle, to those ritual bonfires appropriated and syncretized, if not sanitized, by the Vatican missionaries. Because that's exactly what Burning Man is. A modern example of those same bonfires, albeit devoid of overt Christian significance.
Oh, wow, man.
Now, according to Fraser in his Golden Bough, and remember, he's talking about all the fire festivals of Europe, he says, "Not uncommonly, effigies are burned in these fires, or pretense is made of burning a living person in them, and there are grounds for believing that anciently human beings were actually burned on these occasions."
Yikes!
Consider the fact that Carnival, which is very similar to Burning Man, and vice versa, well, it's celebrated on the very last night of Fat Tuesday by burning a man in effigy. Here in Cologne, he's called Der Nübel, the scapegoat everyone claims was responsible for all of the wild and crazy things they did during the carnival season.
Et letzte Mal stomme he noch zusammen und schmieße die Nubbel in die Flamme.
Of course, all of the fun and all of those wild and crazy excesses, they're the real reason conservative hardliners wanted to rid Christianity of those ritual fires. Can't really be otherwise.
Why not?
Because they already had their own ritual fires, which were all based on their own sense of fun, their own preferred excesses, and their own idea of scapegoats.
Do you know that?
Oh, yeah. You know. Yeah, the Christian fires they lit to celebrate their crazy belief that burning heretics is a fitting human sacrifice to their god.
That's fucking not funny.
True that. But something I really think is funny is that in the year 1520, good Pope Leo X, he got so pissed off at Martin Luther, he released a papal bull condemning Luther and his ideas. Now, the bull is called Exsurge Domini.
Rise up, O Lord, and rid us of the heresies and errors which have been recently propagated among the more frivolous and the illustrious German nation.
After going on for a while, he includes a top 41 list of Luther's poisonous ideas, each of which count as heresy in the eyes of the church. Now, number 31 on that list takes us right back to Jeremiah 7, which, by a clever trail of literary breadcrumbs laid down by our fairy tale author, leads us directly to the satiric intent of Hansel and Gretel, which is, after all, to make fun of and criticize the Vatican. So, without further ado, here is that poisonous and heretical statement of Luther, piously condemned by good Pope Leo.
Hereticos combori est contra voluntatem spiritus.
Burning heretics is against the will of the Holy Spirit.
I'm not saying nothing.
In our next episode, we're going to cut to the chase and find out why Gretel is always crying. I think you're going to be as surprised as I was. In the meantime, check out the website for transcripts, links, and a few more asides I left out of the audio version.
How do I find your show?
You know the drill.
Visit us on the web at www.betweenthelines.xyz.
Check it out now. Do it.
Alrighty then. Ciao a tutti.
Is the show really over?
Ciao, ciao.